integrated the lessons and the tools and the technology and all the things from this last story into the new story, where hopefully there's more equity, hopefully there's more physical and mental health, you know, hopefully there's less violence.
Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge. What if you could hang out with high-performing executives, entrepreneurs, and leaders? Ask them about how psychedelics have impacted their self-improvement journeys. Then take an insight or two to guide your own growth. Each week, Alex Atwood takes an in-depth look at how psychedelics can increase fulfillment, solve personal problems affecting your career, and help you gain the success you seek. Alex is an executive and psychedelics coach to high performers, and his goal is to provide strategies to help you reduce conflict, bring awareness, and balance your life through the use of psychedelics. Now, here's Alex.
Dr. Gabby, welcome to the Alchemist Lounge.
Thanks for having me. This is super fun, Alex.
Absolutely. I'm so excited. I ended up watching some other podcasts that you were on and took a look at your bio, and you have quite the extraordinary journey. So let's jump in. I'd like to start here. You have a wealth of knowledge and experience in holistic health and medicine. What are some common challenges that people face when they're trying to improve their health and well-being?
We are habitual creatures. We don't like change. We think that we like change. We like the idea of changing, but we really like our habits. We really like our comfort zone. We really like things that are familiar, and it takes work. And even when we know the things that we're supposed to be doing, it's hard to do them. And so it requires, beyond like knowledge and information, requires a lot of support, a lot of accountability, and a really strong internal motivation. Like, what's your why? Why do you want to be healthier? Why do you want to live longer? Why do you want to feel better? You know? And so that's what I would say. And what we learn when we study the coaching model, for example, I teach the coaching model at the university where I teach. We look at the stages of change. We look at pre-contemplation, contemplation, action, right? You know, getting to those goals and then the maintenance of that and kind of closure. We look at it as a whole cycle. And so even if you just start to tell your friends, like, I'd really like to lose some weight, I'd really like to quit smoking, that's part of the change cycle. It's just the pre-contemplation stage. And so we look at like the whole thing and try to support people at whatever stage that they're at in making those changes.
Yeah. Coming up with new ways of being and transforming yourself requires, as you said, it requires a support mechanism, like others around you that are enrolled in what your new goal is or how you want to transform, right? And then being able to carve some new neural pathways around that, right? And so it reminds me of something around, I don't remember exactly what the quote was, but something around consistency being the key to that. Yet consistency also creates new habits, which could not allow for the sort of, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Expansion, change, transformation. So how do you overcome that? Like, in other words, you have habits that you want to create, and then those habits turn into other constrictions somewhat,
It's a balance. Yeah. It's a balance, right? We're going to move at the pace that makes sense for the stage of evolution that we're in. And I think you probably had this experience in your own life that there's going to be times of like massive growth and expansion. I mean, that's what psychedelics does, right? You go on a hero's journey of psychedelics, you're like, your whole world is blown open. And then you have a period of integration, right? Where you're sort of like integrating everything that you've learned. And there's some times, you know, where you're just in a dormant phase and like things aren't going to change very much. And I think humans are complex, right? And like the different stages of change, you know, vary. Another way of looking at it is like the seasons. You know, when I did my dissertation research and I interviewed women healers from all over the world, they told me again and again that the healing process, transformation, growth, all of it moves in the cycles, just like the cycles of nature. You have winter, spring, summer, fall, right? You have growth, you have death that's built into like the biological systems, the ecosystem. We have reminders of this all the time. We have the phases of the moon that are constantly happening. And so moving with some of those rhythms, I think, is a way to align that allows you to kind of go in the flow that you're supposed to be going.
I love that. I love that. The cycles and the rhythms and the intelligence of the universe can guide us. Beautiful, beautiful. So can you paint a picture of your childhood for us?
So I just wrote this book called All This Healing Is Killing Me. And it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek name because I've been on this healing journey from my childhood for all of my adult life. And the healing journey is so arduous that sometimes you feel like it's killing you. You're like, really? This is what the universe wants me to do? Really? More ayahuasca? Really? Like, I've been on a healing journey. I grew up in a home that had a lot of domestic violence, addiction, mental illness, all the terrible things. And I was an achiever. So my coping mechanism was to get straight A's and get a PhD and be beautiful and get a modeling contract and travel around the world as a fashion model. And you know, my coping mechanism was just to become as good and successful as I could possibly be. And that worked for a while. But these things are persistent, you know, these things that we don't address. One of the things I say in my book is that we're only as sick as our secrets. And sort of keeping all that shoved down inside, it creates physical and emotional illness. That's just the way that we're made. We need to get it out of our system. We need to clear that stuff out. We need to find ways to heal and to rewire. You mentioned the neural pathways, like rewire our habits and our behaviors so that we're not self-sabotaging, you know, so that we're not picking bad people to date. I picked some very interesting men in my dating life. So So I've been on a journey of recovery from a lot of abuse and a lot of trauma. And I give all those tools in the book. So I write about how I did yoga and meditation and all the therapy and all the, you know, work, the trauma recovery work. And there's a plethora of tools for people to use if they feel like this is something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. Well, you know what I find very interesting is that your coping mechanism in terms of getting straight A's, right? And achieving, creating a goal and then knocking that goal out is seen as success, right? Like you came out of this circumstance, which had a lot of trauma. And I find more often than not that successful, at least materially successful people often come from that sort of background. And using that coping mechanism, actually others see that as you've achieved it, right? That what you call a coping mechanism, others see as a pathway to success. Mm-hmm. But what I heard was that that's not actually the case. Like when you calling something a coping mechanism isn't the same as calling it a tool to gain success, right? Yeah. So like break that down for me a bit, right? So there you are, right? You've gotten straight A's, right? And now you're in a position where you are now potentially getting a model or you got a modeling contract, right? So you have intelligence, you have beauty, you have all these things that the world, you know, sort of grants you success around, right? How did it feel to be there and have that missing there?
Yeah, I mean, everything you're saying is super insightful and getting that kind of big picture of like the systems support this, right? The systems support us not talking about mental illness. The systems support us not talking about depression, anxiety, addiction, right? The system says, no, just keep going, just keep smiling. You know, that will make everything, just keep reaching, achieving, buying shit. Keep buying shit to make yourself feel better. Buy more makeup, buy more clothes, like
earn more money.
So it's really insightful to kind of have that big picture. The personal experience of being in that is like just feeling so uncomfortable in your own skin. It just feels like you just want to rip your own skin off because you're like, oh God, like, and it feels as though like there isn't a safe place to actually express, because one of my friends asked me when she read the book, she's like, I'm so mad at you. And I was like, why are you mad at me? She's like, why did you ever tell me any of the stuff that's in your book? And I was like, well, it's not until recently that you could feel safe having those conversations and not worry about a lot of the consequences of having those conversations. This has been like a long journey, I think, collectively for all of us to get to the point where athletes are coming out, right? Entrepreneurs are coming out. Like people are coming out and saying, no, me too. Me too. This is happening. I have PTSD or I have, you know, these issues as well. And so it was a while to get there, but like I went through a long time of just feeling really uncomfortable. And like anything else in life, you can still have a lot of fun, right? You can still have a lot of fun in pursuit of success. And I was traveling and I was, you know, there were still aspects of it that had a lot of joy, but then I couldn't be alone with myself. If I was ever alone with myself, I was just so deeply scared and sad that I just couldn't sit for 2 seconds and be alone. And then that's when you realize like, oh, I don't think this is the way that it's supposed to be. I don't think I'm supposed to need something all the time to feel better. I think I'm supposed to be able to just sit and be content and just appreciate whatever is happening in the moment.
Yeah. So, you know, when did you discover that there was another, there was something else there?
I think I always sensed it. You know, I was always a spiritual seeker. I grew up in the Catholic community, but then I started to pursue Buddhism and yoga and like look at all the different spiritual traditions. And I think I always sensed like the Buddha had some kind of secret sauce, like something was happening. I mean, it wouldn't be around for like 5,000 years if there wasn't something about it, right? So, but when I would sit in these practices, I would just be bombarded with like, you know, just so much inner drama and pain and memories and all the things. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? It always felt like I was doing something wrong. And so it just took a lot more work. And maybe this is going to be true for a lot of people. I mean, I think we have like 1 in 8 people worldwide have some kind of mental illness. So I think maybe this is going to be true for a lot of people. It just took a lot more work to clean my internal house until I could get to the point where I could sit. And now I can. Now I can just feel really good. Like on my lunch break today, I just went for a bike ride and it was amazing. It was like, it was amazing. I just kept riding my bike being like, how did I get so lucky? How did I get so lucky? Like, and that was it. Like there was nothing extraordinary except it was extraordinary. And I think that we should be able to feel that level of awe and gratitude for the daily things. But that's only because I've been working on this shit for a very, very long time.
What you're pointing at right now, I hear so often from people that they feel that they always need to be productive. They, you know, they used to call it workaholic. I don't know if that's still a word that they use, but always having to be producing something or creating something. And if you're not in the process of creating or thinking or ideating, then somehow your value to yourself is diminished. And so it sounds like you had early on discovered some spiritual practices, right, that somehow manifested themselves at a certain point in your life. And you mentioned that some of the practices you had just weren't working. So what tool did you use that finally worked, that unlocked things for you?
I think it was a gradual process of working through the things that needed to be worked through. With regards to like productivity, I'm still addicted to productivity. Like it's really hard for me to have a whole day where I don't check anything off the to-do list. Like yesterday I was spending the day with my sister, we were going to brunch, but like I had to get my car washed and like go to the post office or something. Like I had to like get in some productivity because I'm still like addicted to productivity. So I don't think we ever get to the point where we have some kind of, I don't know, perfect blissful life, but what I did was work on things over time. You know, as a teenager, like after I left modeling, I did 4 years of psychotherapy. I tried all the antidepressant, all the medications. That didn't work so good. I went through all the holistic therapies, like while I was doing my trainings and becoming, you know, the PhD professor. I did yoga trainings, meditation trainings. I did 10-day Vipassana retreats. I did all those things. And like little by little, for me, it was kind of putting the pieces of myself back together. Like when I was in massage school, for example, I was getting massages, and I write about this in my book, All This Healing Is Killing Me. Like when I would get massages, I would like start crying. I would have some kind of emotional release. And I didn't even know that that was like a thing. And then my teacher told me like, no, it's common when people get any kind of body work or chiropractic work or acupuncture, that if there are emotions that haven't been released, they start coming out. And so like little by little, I started acquiring all these different therapies and practices and tools, because I had a lot that I needed to work through. And then eventually the sort of concluding chapter in my book, like spoiler alert, I go to this, I go to this boot camp out in Arizona that just like totally wrecks me in the best possible way. And like, I feel like I had been building up towards that for a very long time, but that really kind of got me across the finish line in terms of really processing a lot of unprocessed grief and anger and stuff that was lingering that I really needed to get out of my system. And then the last 3 years, I've been on a journey of psychedelic medicine. So I've been working with psilocybin and peyote and ayahuasca and all these unbelievably beautiful healing sacred plants. And that has been like next level. I mean, it's really just like opened up a whole world that I didn't even know existed. So I think it's a journey, and I don't, I don't think if you had the option to like snap your fingers and just get to the end, that would be very, I don't think you would want that. There was all the people that I met, all the healers that I met, all the stories I read, all the stories I wrote, like my whole life is, you know, part of this, integrated into this. I wouldn't give it up, you know?
Yeah, it's absolutely the journey. And what I find very interesting in your story is that you had a modeling career and you were also going through your own personal transformation. And then you dedicated your life, well, your career, I should say, to holistic health and alternative medicine, and then pursued a PhD, right? So did that that personal transformation unlock what your career path eventually transformed you into now?
Yeah. I feel like my career chose me. I don't feel like it was a choice, because I was like, you know, a 19-year-old, like, oh my God, like, I'm going to do modeling. Yeah. I'm going to travel. Like, I was like the Instagram influencer, you know, version of, you know, 1992 or whatever. I just was like, I wanted to be pretty and I wanted to be popular. Yeah. That's what I wanted. And the universe was just like, no, that's not what we're doing. You know, that's not what's going to happen for your life. The universe just had a whole different trajectory for me. And it started at my mother's funeral. My mother died when I was 21. I write about this in the book. It's how the book opens. And at my mother's funeral, I have a mystical experience and like my whole life changes in the blink of an eye. And the universe was just like, we're going in this direction. This is the direction that we're going. And my life has been an unfolding ever since then of seeking answers, seeking practices, trying to help other people to understand things about their physical and mental and spiritual health. Yeah, I really feel like it's been a calling and more of a, I don't know, more of a kind of a divine path than I anticipated when I was 19 and running around in mini skirts in the bars with my friends.
Well, let's talk about your book. And I'd love to hear a little bit. I mean, that sounds like such an impactful event, you know, that happened at your mother's funeral. What inspired you to write All This Healing Is Killing Me?
It's the same story of the universe being like, you're going to write this book. So after I finished my dissertation, I wrote my dissertation about women healers. And I like, that was my way of like appeasing, okay, I'm going to write a dissertation about women healers. And then after I finished the dissertation, I hadn't told my own story. And so I just felt this like urgency, like the urgency, like when you have to like sneeze or like this, like, oh, I gotta get
like it's
this.
Coming regardless.
I know it's coming and I cannot stop it. Like I just felt it coming. So I wrote the first draft in 2007. I put it away and I was just like doing my life. And then I felt the urgency come back to revisit again in 2013. So I wrote it again in 2013 and finally got the courage to give it to an editor who told me it was terrible. So I put it back. And then I took it out again during the pandemic, which I think this is the story of a lot of people. I think the pandemic was a big purge for a lot of people to kind of get out some stuff. And maybe it showed up in your relationships or your career. But for me, the book came back like a third and final time and was like, I am going to like, I don't know, hold you down until you get this. Like, this is what we're doing. We're doing this book. And it sounds, I don't know, fantastical to describe it in this way, but really the book was just insistent in the way that I would wake up and I would be hearing the narration of the book in my mind. And I would try to distract myself and I would be hearing the book in my mind and I'd be like, oh my God. So the third and final time I got it right, I sent it to an editor who is also life-changing and she molded it into what people are holding in their hands today. And I'm so glad I finally finished the book because it's been such a relief, because it's like anything else. You're carrying something around with you for a really long time that's supposed to be in the world. And yeah, it's uncomfortable until you get it out.
Absolutely. You know, I've spoken with artists who have projects that hang over them, whether it's a song, whether it's a painting, whatever it is, it's an expression that's there. It's in the world and it was created as a thing, as an actual idea. So it's actually there. It's energy. And now it needs to be manifested into whatever it's meant to be. So congratulations on that. What's the one thing you would want people to take away after reading the book?
Yeah, the one thing I want them to take away is that if they've tried a lot of the of things that have not helped in their own journey, please try writing. Writing was so medicinal for me. Please try writing. Please write your own story. Please write your own story for yourself. You need to hear your own story. Even if nobody else hears it, which I highly recommend you sharing it with people that you trust, please consider writing your own story, sharing your own story. I can't emphasize enough the transformative power of writing, and writing was so medicinal for me. I really think that it's important that it's something that people consider. And I was saying this on another interview, and the host said, it's so funny. She's like, I've been in all these branding workshops and marketing workshops, and they always say, tell your story, you know, but it's always this like very superficial marketing version of your story. And that's not the story that I'm talking about. I'm talking about write down all the stuff you don't want anybody to know. Like everything that's in my book is something, Alex, that I don't want you to know about me. Like on every single page is something I don't want you to know about me. And that's what's significant about it. Yes. That's what's significant about it.
So you're sharing from an extremely vulnerable place.
It's all the things. It's all the things that I don't want anybody to know. And now that it's out, it's like, what a relief. Because now everybody knows everything that I don't want them to know. So it's like, and I didn't die. The earth is still turning and it's still, you know, circling the sun. So I survived the writing, I survived the publishing. And I think that that's what we need to do. We need to survive the vulnerability and realize that we're still going to be okay.
Yeah. Well, now you've took power back from whatever those things were that had some sort of power control over you. And so what I'm hearing is that for those that have gone through trauma, for those that don't know quite what to do in terms of tackling this anxiety or whatever shows up, this missing, one method would be to write. Just write. Write your story. Start to write and get it out there. And write in the most vulnerable way that you possibly can. Now, you've went out there and published it as well. So I don't know if you're recommending that everyone publishes, but that is another step towards being fully self-expressed. So
yeah,
that's awesome.
I'm a rebellious person by nature. And I think it was important for me to share my story because I do have a lot of students and a lot of clients that have looked up to me for a very long time. And I want to humanize myself. I know that I can be influential in the best possible way, you know, with patients, with clients, with students, you know, even at my job at Third Wave, I know I bring a lot to the table and I want to humanize myself and I want other people to feel safe to be able to do that too, especially in my presence. Don't bullshit me when you're hanging out with me. Just be yourself, like be your most authentic self. That's the people that I want in my life. And if I'm not showing up in that way, then I'm not surrounded by people who are comfortable to show up in that way. If you're with me, I want you to feel safe to be who you actually are. I don't want you to feel like you have to like pretend or, you know, send a representative. I want you to really be you. And that level of intimacy that I'm able to achieve with myself and other people, for me, is so grounding and satisfying and comforting. I really want to be able to have that intimacy. And until I really like lay it all out there, I can't have that kind of intimacy with my family and friends.
So it brings to mind, there was somebody I was talking to not too long ago that was actually the head of pastor in a very large megachurch. And what he was saying was, it wasn't a fanatical megachurch. I mean, it was one with lots of inclusion and the topics weren't so rigid, which was interesting. And he showed me one of the tapes and he's wearing like something super casual. I think it might've been sweatpants even, right? And I asked him, I said, wow, that's different. You know, I expected you to go up in a full suit, right? He said, well, I want to be relatable to everyone in that audience. And if I show up in a suit and some of the people in the congregation don't have a suit or they feel like that puts some sort of wall between them and I, then I want to be the least well-dressed person in the room so that I'm completely relatable. And very interesting take on things, right? And I was really happy to see that somebody in that position would see things as being, you know, sort of putting themselves in a position where they are accessible and they're, you know, sort of part of the community. So that's such a great place to be. It really is. So what about people that are like looking to find balance? So and they don't see how could they possibly find time to write a book? I'm sure there's people listening that, well, I have this and I have kids and I have, you know, all these obligations. And yes, I do feel like something's missing. But I just don't have time to address it. So how do you advise those that just can't seem to find the time to address this?
There's something called morning pages that comes from The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And it's just getting up and doing stream of consciousness morning pages in the morning for a few minutes. I think that's a great place to start. Like, I don't think anything that we're doing for self-care or personal transformation or personal growth, I don't think any of it has to completely consume our lives. I think it can be integrated. Another thing that I do and I did while I was writing is I made voice notes while I was walking, because most people are doing some kind of exercise or fitness. But most people, while they're doing that, are consuming something, right? They're consuming an audiobook or a podcast or so, like they're like in this consumption mode. And I think too much consumption is not good for us. Like, I just think you need output as well as input. And I think sometimes you're just doing way too much input and not enough output. So what I would do when I was walking is the whole time I was walking, I would talk into my voice notes and then I would come home and transcribe them. And that way, like, the walks became about output and not about consuming other people's ideas. And that really creates space for all the other productivity. And like, a lot of times we feel like we don't have enough time, but sometimes time's not the problem. Sometimes there's just not a lot of space, right? It feels like a time thing, but it's like a space thing. And for me, the space thing is like, there has to be some kind of discharge. You mentioned energy, which I totally agree with you about everything being energy. There's got to be some discharge for that energy. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if you've noticed this, but like all of a sudden all your tasks line up and you just kind of get them done, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you're like, whoa, that was easy. You know, it wasn't like,
oh yeah,
such a struggle. And I think that we can create that like sense of efficiency, and flow is another word that describes it, when we have more balance. I think we don't have to think of balance as another thing to do. We can just think of it as something to integrate to make everything more efficient, you know, that we're working on.
I love that. I particularly love how you made a distinction between consumption and what'd you call it? You said, production,
input.
I love that. Yeah. I love input and output. Because these days with technology where it is, why not begin to put some output there? Like, begin to take those thoughts and have them transcribed and review them later. So synthesize this into your daily schedule. That's a very practical tip. And I personally, and I, you know, I don't use it anymore, unfortunately. But I downloaded an app that told me that, you know, when, how was your day? Tell us, you know, tell me how your day was. And it would track my writing, because one of the 18 months now, but 18 months ago, I made a commitment to myself to begin journaling. And I found it extremely difficult to work it in to my schedule. So I picked up an app and it gave me prompts, and just typing, you know, just answering a prompt, just a quick prompt, just kind of set things in the right direction. Now, creating a habit, which we talked about in the beginning of our conversation, is something else, right?
Right.
And what you pointed out there was, well, once you have a desire, once you have a true desire for transformation, then you start to put action in place and the habits start to come through, right? So I'm really just taking all of this in, because the journaling piece is something that I've been wanting to really implement. So I think that using the transcription is a good way to do that. And it gives me, instead of having AI determine what questions it's going to ask me, it actually centers in on what I'm doing today.
Yeah.
So that that's really great.
Yeah, and the transcriptions, you'll be astonished. Like, when you take that back, like, you can either transcribe it yourself, which is what I would do while I was writing, or you can just like send it to Fiverr or something and someone else will transcribe it for you. But I think you'll be astonished when you see the words in writing that like came out of your head into your voice and then onto the page. I think you'll be astonished. I would read it and I'd be like, whoa. You know?
Yeah.
And we've just become so numb in so many ways. And we've sort of outsourced a lot of creativity. I think we used to have a time where, like, you know, every night you would come home and you'd sit around the porch and you'd tell each other stories, stories of the day or stories of the family, or like, it was like a normal thing that there was a lot of sharing. And we've just gotten to the point where we just sit and stare at a light box, you know, and someone else is writing the stories and telling the stories. I think it can be really disempowering. And seeing and hearing your own story, or even listening to the voicemail back, like if I would do an hour walk, sometimes I'd talk for 30 minutes and then I'd listen to it for the second 30 minutes. And just listening to myself, my own voice and my own thoughts, cultivated a relationship with myself that I didn't have before. It's like, oh, you're a person. I'm like, you're here. We're here. This is us. Like, you know, and how can I expect other people to listen to me if I can't even listen to myself? Like, it's gotta start with me listening to myself.
Yeah. So let's move into psychedelics.
Okay.
That's always a fun and fascinating topic. And that's how we connected. So how do psychedelics play a role currently in terms of your current state of transformation, where you are now evolving?
Yes. Well, I've transitioned to working in psychedelics full time. So it's a big part of my professional life. And as part of my professional life, I'm connecting with hundreds, if not thousands, of people all over the world who are facilitating in psychedelics, researching in psychedelics, taking psychedelics, writing about psychedelics. It's really unbelievably phenomenal. I just was in South by Southwest in Austin at a bunch of panels and parties. And before that was at Cannadelic in Miami, Wonderland, giving talks, giving presentations. During the pandemic, I lived with indigenous healers. I lived with a medicine woman in Taos, New Mexico, and we worked with peyote. I lived with a woman in Guatemala, and we worked with psilocybin. And so living with different healers and learning about the different properties, and then connecting with like the modern community or the Western community, which is, you know, integrated a lot with technology, like WhatsApp groups and podcasts and things like that. So exploring that whole ecosystem, meeting all my fellow psychonauts, and then personally using the different medicines when I need them. I'm a huge fan of microdosing. I don't do a lot of heroic doses. I can count on my hand like how many times I've done heroic doses. But for me, microdosing just feels like it builds resilience. It feels like it builds wellness, and I think it really supports my physical and mental health. So that's what I gravitate towards. That's what works best for me. And that's what I like to promote. And I think it's a good place for people to start. I was just having a conversation with someone yesterday who's like, I'm going to do ayahuasca. And I was like, okay, but have you ever done any psychedelics? No. Okay. And like, what's your diet like? And what's your alcohol consumption? And like, I think that some things become popular. Ayahuasca is really popular. And I think some things become popular, and we need really good education, which is why the third wave training is so great. We need really good education around what you should do, how you should do it, who should support you, what you can expect, how you integrate. So that these things can become safe and mainstream, and we don't have another kind of backlash like we had 50 years ago, where, you know, we lost so much momentum. We lost like 40, 50 years of research that we could have right now that we don't have because we made mistakes. So,
yeah. And you're referring to the second wave and what happened there, which is what we get to sort of pick up the baton from there and carry it forward to have it heal. When I think about microdosing and I think about psychedelics and just how small, even though in our world, in terms of being in the psychedelic community, we see so much happening and we see so much potential and possibility. And it's still a very small fraction of the population as a whole in the US and across the world. So we definitely have our work cut out for us. That's for sure. And to that end, you said something that highly resonate with, which is these medicines are extremely powerful. And as celebrities like Aaron Rodgers or other celebrities, I think, you know, there's a host of them, I don't even, MGK or, you know, whoever, start to promote these different methods to find quote unquote enlightenment, you do run into that situation where someone doesn't do the necessary pre-work in order to really experience the transformation that's there. So it's important, and I just want to reemphasize this, that these are very, very powerful medicines and they are to be treated as such. And so definitely take your time if you're interested in doing any of these psychedelic medicines, even microdosing, make sure that there's an intention there and that you take your time, find the right coach. The third wave community is a vast ecosystem of different accessibility to information around this, coaches around this, and all of that. So anyone interested in doing that, definitely do your homework. And ultimately, psychedelics are a very powerful tool that can be used in, you know, in the world and for individuals themselves. And so can writing. So let me ask you this. So where do you see the psychedelic community and how psychedelics could impact the world? What do you see that major impact that these medicines and this work could have in the world?
I think these medicines are like a midwife to the new paradigm and the new world. I think they're stewarding us into all the changes that we need to make. And one of my favorite authors is Charles Eisenstein. I don't know if you know his work, but he wrote a book called The More Beautiful World Our Heart Knows Is Possible. And he talks about this time as being a time between stories, that there's an old story that all of us are starting to be like, oh yeah, that's a bunch of bullshit. That's like, but like, we don't have a new story. Like, we haven't written the new world and integrated the lessons and the tools and the technology and all the things from this last story into the new story, where hopefully there's more equity, hopefully there's more physical and mental health, you know, hopefully there's less violence and living with, he describes the relationship with the earth as lover earth, moving from mother earth to lover earth, where we really treat the planet with a lot more respect. So I see the medicines as ushering in a lot of that. And I felt that in my own body as they were working on me. I became so much more conscious of the air and the light and the earth and all of it. Just became so much more conscious of food, and not coming from a place of forcing myself to eat food because I was supposed to, but actually wanting to, like preferring the taste of food that was alive to the food that was processed and packaged, like really just my preferences shifted. So I really see it as a medicine that's moving us collectively into a new story, a new paradigm, and the next iteration of who we are as a humanity. That's like best case scenario. Worst case scenario is it just helps a lot of people. Like it just helps a lot of people, a lot of people who have physical pain, mental pain, you know, who are suicidal or addicted to opioids or alcohol. Like, worst case scenario, it just helps a lot of people because it is really powerful medicine. And we know the efficacy. We have the research. We don't have as much of it as we need, but we have enough of it to know that it can help people. So it's a good medicine, you know, even if it doesn't create this new world, it will make people feel better, which, I mean, everybody deserves to feel better. Everybody deserves to have a better quality of life. You know, we all deserve to have a good, healthy, positive experience. So it can do that for sure.
Absolutely. There are so many possibilities out there with not just psychedelic medicine, but just in the way that, possibly because of the pandemic, but people are starting to see health, wellness in terms of their own personal, as you said, journey, and how, you know, the importance of family, the importance of writing your story, the importance of self-reflection was, if we can look at anything that, you know, any silver lining to the pandemic, that's definitely one. So this was an awesome conversation. It was a lot of fun. The book is called All This Healing Is Killing Me. It's available on Amazon. It is a culmination of what it sounds like is a few decades of putting this together and finally putting it out there for the world to see all your vulnerability. So those of you that listen to this will get to hear all of the things Dr. Gabby never wanted you to necessarily know, and now she puts it out there. So I can't think of a better incentive to go and get the book and read all about how she transformed and healed in very holistic ways. And what else is it that you would like to share with the audience before we close the show? Is there anything else that we would like to discuss here?
I mean, don't hesitate to reach out. I can point you towards a lot of resources if you need resources. You know, connect with us at Third Wave, connect with me personally. I'm Dr. Gabby Polici on all the channels. And yeah, just trust yourself. Trust yourself. Listen to your intuition. Turn off the noise. Get quiet. Trust yourself. I think that we have a lot more intuitive wisdom than we give ourselves credit for. And
yeah,
and that voice will guide you in this process.
I love that. It reminds me of an 80s song. Listen to your heart when it's calling for... Remember that song? You probably don't. It's really goofy.
Oh, you do? I remember that song.
I don't know who sang that or anything, but just listen to your heart. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Gabby. Yeah. This is an awesome interview. Thank you for being so vulnerable, not just on this show, but just in your work and for listening to your heart and for moving in the direction of transformation. Never comfortable, but it's always transformational. And I really appreciate you sharing your story with us and coming onto the Alchemist Lounge.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.